It claims to be recording, like it is. All right, now, questions?
Just the general concept of rent-seeking.
Sure. Rent-seeking is spending resources in order that I will have something instead of someone else having it, as opposed to spending resources in order that something will exist that otherwise wouldn't exist. That's a rough... Only something, of course, is a somewhat oversimplification, because if I spend my resources removing boxes of flour from a wholesaler's warehouse to the homes of customers, the amount of stuff is the same, but I've really created something because it's now in a more useful place. So that's productive activity, even though it's not producing things. But if I spend my resources scouting out your house so as to burglarize it, that expenditure only has the purpose of transfers from you to me. And if you spend your resources on hiring somebody to watch for people scouting out your house, that also only has the effect of giving you something instead of me. That is, defenses against crime, really, logically speaking, are rent-seeking too, since they're an expenditure on a changing a distribution, namely keeping my stuff from going to you. And the problem with rent-seeking, from an economic standpoint, is that you're spending resources and producing nothing and thus making us on net worse off. And the idea, as far as I know, the first published explanation of the idea was an article by Gordon Tullock, who did not use the term rent-seeking, called The Welfare Costs of Tariffs, Monopoly, and Theft. And he was arguing that in the case of, say, a tariff, there is a sort of traditional economic analysis which shows why a tariff makes the country that imposes it poorer, worse off, because it results in producing things at home that you can get more cheaply by producing something else at home and then exchanging it with people abroad. And Tullock's point was that's not all of the cost of tariffs. The other cost is that because it is possible by spending money on politics to get a tariff passed protecting your industry, industries have an incentive to spend resources on lobbying in order to get tariffs, and that itself is a deadweight cost. That's rent-seeking, though he didn't use the term. Similarly, there is a traditional analysis of the welfare cost of monopoly, which ultimately comes from the fact that the monopoly is charging a price above cost of production, with the result that there are some consumers who value the good at more than it costs to produce but don't get it. That's an inefficiency, the lack of an opportunity for a net gain. Tullock said, well, that's all very well, but there's a further cost, because since if you have a monopoly, you'll have monopoly profit. Firms have an incentive to spend resources making sure that they, instead of somebody else, is the monopoly. And I don't remember if it's in this book, but I have an example somewhere where I imagine that somewhere out west there's a valley into which it will eventually be worth running a railroad line. And it'll never be worth running two railroad lines into it. And the argument is that you will build your railroad line before the point at which the freight pays for it, in order to nail down the monopoly so that when more people settle the valley, you'll be able to get monopoly profits there. And that's an extra deadweight cost in addition to the inefficiency of monopoly. So those are all examples. And then somewhat later, Ann Kruger wrote an article called The Economics of the Rent-Seeking Society, I think. And she coined the term, and her example was exchange controls, that you had poor countries where the government had set an official exchange rate for their currency that greatly overvalued the currency. So you have a situation, let us say, where a dollar will buy as much as 10 rupees. But the Indian government says 5 rupees are worth a dollar. They're overstating the value of the rupee. And how do they enforce it? They say that if you're an Indian firm that sells goods abroad and gets dollars, you must exchange them at the official rate with the government bank. And if you're an Indian firm that wants to import goods, which means you've got to get dollars, you have to get permission from the government, at which point the government will then give you dollars in exchange for your rupees at the official rate value. Since the official value is giving you twice as many dollars as your rupees are worth, the piece of paper letting you exchange 10,000 rupees into dollars is worth a lot of money. And her argument was that then firms in such countries spent resources making sure that they, instead of somebody else, got those import permits. And that consumed sizable amounts of wealth. So that's the context of that. And then it's a little less clear whether you are planning to spend your lives at rent-seeking, because it's unclear whether you should think of a civil case as rent-seeking. All right, if you imagine a tort case, one way of looking at it is, what are you doing? You're spending time and effort making sure, if you're the plaintiff's lawyer, that money is transferred from the defendant to the plaintiff, and if you're the defendant's lawyer, making sure that it isn't. That looks an awful lot like rent-seeking. But one might argue, no, it's a productive activity, because what you're really doing by generating information on both sides of the case is making it more likely that that defendants who are at fault will lose and defendants who aren't at fault will win, and that's a productive activity. Production. All right. Other questions? All right. Let's go on to this week's reading, which consisted of the spaghetti diagram chapter and the Coase article. Are there questions about that that you would like to raise, things that struck you when you were reading that material? All right, let me run a very quick review of what we did last week and then go on from there. And we start with the externality problem, and the basic problem is that because people making decisions don't take account of the external costs and benefits of their decisions, they may sometimes make a decision which is the right decision for them but not for us. All right, the underlying problem is, how do you set up the world so that individuals acting in their own self-interest will in some sense act in the general interest? And that's sort of an idea which is sometimes referred to by Adam Smith's metaphor of an invisible hand. People are moved as by an invisible hand to do good things that are not their intent. And the simple way is, in an ordinary market society, if I need inputs to make something, I've got to pay for them, so I've got to buy them at their value from the seller. If I want to get money, I've got to sell my output. People will only pay me at most what the output is worth. So if what it's worth is more than what the inputs cost, it'll pay me to make it. If it isn't, I won't. Nice, simple argument for how you make the world work. And there's a good deal of power to it, a good deal of that. That's true. But often, in taking actions, you also impose some costs you don't have to pay for. Sometimes the benefits you don't have you can't charge other people for. If you ignore those, there will be cases where your calculation of whether to do or not to do something gives the opposite answer from a calculation that included everybody. Right? That's the basic externality problem. And Pigou's solution to that problem was, if I'm taking an action that imposes costs on somebody else, have the government bill me for those costs. And you could imagine doing that in the form of a fine or a tax, which is, I think, what Pigou imagined, but you could also think of the tort system as something very much along those lines, except that now the money goes to the victim. All right. Coase's critique of that starts out with the argument that my imposing costs on you misdescribes the situation. Everybody had misunderstood what was happening, because what's really happening is that you and I are imposing a cost, which might end up on you or might end up on me, depending on the circumstances. That you and I are both making decisions, and it's the intersection of those decisions that causes the problem. So, for example, there would be no problem with airport noise if there weren't noisy airplanes coming into San Jose Mineta Airport. But there would also be no problem with airport noise if all that was underneath the flight path was grass. Grass is not bothered by noise. So it's the joint decision of the airlines to fly airplanes in and of the owners of the property to do things with the property that would be bothered by noise. They're just having houses on it that causes the problem. And if you take Pigou's formula blindly, and you pick one person and say he's imposing the cost, we'll make him pay for it, you may end up with the wrong person solving the problem at the higher cost. So that if you say, for example, that take the tort version, if you say that the airlines are liable in tort for the cost of the noise, now there's no reason for me not to build a house under the airline, under the flight path, because what I lose in noise I'll make up for in tort damages, and yet I'm imposing real costs by doing that. All right? And similar problems of somewhat different sorts arise if it's a fine instead of a tort. But the basic argument is that because you thought of it as unicausal when it's really bicausal, you got answers which sometimes would make it better, sometimes would make it worse. And then in some situations, leaving it alone will solve the problem, and in some it won't. That was the first step of Coase's argument, and that's what I think of as nothing works. All right. Second step of Coase's argument is to say, wait a minute, why can't these people talk to each other? If I'm imposing a cost on you, you ought to be willing to offer me something to stop doing it. Assuming that if I'm imposing a cost on you and the law lets me impose that cost, then you would think that you would have an incentive to go to me and say, here's what I'm willing to offer to get you to stop what you're doing. All right? And if I'm imposing a cost on you and the law says you've got the right to stop me, but stopping is really expensive for me, I ought to be willing to go to you and say, look, you've got the right to get an injunction to stop me making noise in my factory, but that's going to cost me a fortune. That noise is only a minor problem for you, so how about I pay you to drop the injunction? So the Coasean argument carried all the way is that as long as transaction costs are zero, or to put it differently, as long as any time that there's an agreement between two people that would make them both better off, it happens, then externality problems should all disappear, because any time I'm ignoring the cost I impose on you, but you're not, that means you're willing to pay me to stop it, and the fact you're willing to pay me to stop it means that there's now a cost to me to keep on doing it, namely losing what you'd be willing to pay me to stop it. All right, that's an opportunity. Does the argument make sense so far? Yes, no? All right, so that's the second step of Coase's argument, which is everything works. That if you give me the right, and I'm the person who ought to be doing it, if my noisy factory, stop closing down my noisy factory is much more expensive than the nuisance I'm imposing on you, if I've got the right, you won't be willing to offer me enough to get me to close down the factory, and I'll keep running the factory. If you have the right, I'll be willing to offer you enough to buy permission to keep operating the factory, I'll keep operating it. Turn it around. If the costs that my factory are imposing on you are much larger than the cost to me of making my factory quiet, if I have the right, I'll accept an offer from you to agree not to make noise, and if you have the right, I won't be able to buy it from you because I won't be willing to offer you enough to do it. All right, so that's the basic Coasean argument, and that's what I think George Stigler, somebody, but I think it's George Stigler, called the Coase theorem. That in a world of zero transaction costs, any initial assignment of right will still give you an efficient outcome. Then the third step is, and this is all Coase still, and the third step is to say, well, we do have transaction costs in the real world, and therefore, when you're looking at an inefficiency that you used to blame on externality, you really ought to be asking, what are the transaction costs that prevent the private arrangements that would solve this problem, that would get people to the efficient end? All right, so that's the sort of three stages of Coase's argument, and that's an argument that really changed fundamentally the way people thought about that set of issues. And I should say, part of the way Coase got there, I think it's pretty clear if you look at the article, is by looking at English law, because the judges in England in the 19th and maybe the 18th century had seen essentially the point that Coase was making, that various things that happened were really the fault of both parties, and therefore you couldn't simply assign it as one party imposing costs on others. All right. Given that perspective, what does that imply for the legal system? And there are a number of possible things that you could imagine doing. One of them would be that the court looks at each case, decides who is the lowest cost avoider of the problem, and tells them what to do. All right, so the court says the cheapest way of keeping sulfur dioxide from poisoning people's air is not to move the people, but to put on high smokestacks. That's a regulatory solution. Next, that requires, of course, that the court have a whole lot of knowledge for reasons we've discussed that the court probably doesn't have, but it's in principle a possible decision. And you might argue there are cases where it's the right decision. For example, if you think about the question of murder, the way our legal system handles the question of murder is not to say that if you murder somebody, we'll charge you a fine. It is to try, not very entirely successfully, to prevent all murders on the theory that it believes essentially all murders to be inefficient. That would be the economist's way of putting it, not the way the court would put it, of course. The second possibility is that the court decides who is the lowest cost avoider and makes him liable. That is, or imposes the Pigouvian tax, but basically uses Pigou's solution after first deciding which of the parties is the one who ought to do it. Now, not only does that require information by the court about who's the lower cost avoider, it also assumes that there is a single lowest cost avoider. But there may be cases where the cheapest way of solving a problem is for me to do some things or for you to do some things. And then the third possibility, and the one which I at least think of as the implication of Coase, but I'm not entirely sure if Coase does so or not. My chapter discussing Coase is to some extent based on an article I wrote, and Coase's comment on the article was, you never really understand your ideas till other people explain them to you. And given Ronald Coase, I do not to this day know if he had his tongue in his cheek or not, if he was being sarcastic. I suppose he's still alive, I could ask him, but he's not around here. Anyway, but the way I see it, at least, is the natural implication of the analysis, is that when you draw up general legal rules, you try to draw up the general legal rules that will, in the kind of situation the rule applies to, generally put the obligation on the lower cost avoider. And a simple example of that would be the coming to the nuisance rule. People familiar with the common law rule of coming to the nuisance? I buy some land several miles beyond the city limits where there's nothing but green fields and set up a pig farm there. 5 years later, you buy an adjacent plot of land, the city having expanded meanwhile so its border has gotten closer, and build a suburban housing development there. You then observe that nobody wants to live in a housing development next to a pig farm because of the noise and sounds and various unpleasantnesses, so you sue me to close down the pig farm as a nuisance on the grounds that from an economist standpoint, I'm imposing negative externalities on you by having a pig farm. What the doctrine of coming to the nuisance says is first in time is first in right. That because I had my pig farm before you had your housing development, I have the right to continue operating it as I did. You may, if you wish, buy me out if I'm willing to sell, but it is I, not you, who has the right. Now, I should say, since some of you are going to be lawyers, not all modern courts always accept this doctrine. It's a doctrine that I think pretty well established in the common law in the past, and there's been some retreat from it since. And one could make an economic argument, we'll come to that probably at some later point in the course, for why maybe it's not always the right one. But if you think about it from this perspective, the argument for coming to the nuisance rule is that it's a whole lot cheaper to move things before you build them than afterwards. And that therefore, as a general rule, saying the person who came first has the right means that at the point when the conflict becomes visible, it's the person who hasn't yet built who is going to have to bear the cost, and he can much more cheaply adjust by building somewhere else rather than saying, we've got your pig farm now, burn it down. So it's at least a plausible case of an argument for saying that you can understand this legal rule as an attempt to put the obligation to solve the problem on the prisoner to solve it at a lower cost. And that would be an example, and you can think of other things. The last clear chance rule would be another rule that makes sense in the same fashion, that if some string of actions only leads to a problem, three steps up in the string, it would be very costly for me to prevent the problem because I don't know if the other two are going to happen or not. Whereas the last person in that chain, when your car has stalled on the railroad track and my train doesn't have brakes that will let it stop in 15 feet, the last clear chance is the engineer who at that point ought to be watching out and stop the train whenever 100 yards back or whatever, however long things the train stop before it runs into your car. All right. And it's worth noticing that it's a little point which we'll be coming to, you've now already read because it's a good deal of the chapter, that the first best solution is if there's one person who should solve the problem, make him liable. But since you, when you're writing a general rule, you don't always know who should solve the problem, you also want to think about, if we've given it to the wrong person, how easy it will be for private transactions to fix it. So that if you think about the difference, about all of the problems that I run through in that chapter with my farmers and my railroads, there are some transfers of rights that run into serious transactional problems, such as ones which require 100 people to cooperate in buying out a right. There are others that have much less serious problems, so you want to think up a rule which first makes liable the person who can best solve the problem, but second sets it up in a way such that if he's not the one who can best solve the problem, a transaction between him and the one who can won't be too hard. All right. So that's a sort of a very, very general prescription for how you might write efficient legal rules. Notice as one of the many issues that these could apply to, the distinction between bright line rules and standards. All right, a bright line rule, let's take the case of running for president in the U.S., a bright line rule might be that you must be at least 35 to run for president. Now, that's clearly the wrong rule, right? There are some people well over 35 who are less mature than some 20-year-olds. One might even argue that one or two of them have been elected president in the past. And there are some people who are 20 or 25 who are more mature than most 35-year-olds. The example I like to offer for that is that when my daughter was a baby, we were living in Chicago, and we found a girl who was, I think, 11 or 12 to do babysitting. And the original plan was that she could pay attention to the baby while my wife was cooking dinner. And it turned out that we had found a 12-year-old grown-up. And we, after dealing with her for a while, felt perfectly comfortable leaving her in complete charge of the baby while we went off somewhere for half an hour to go shopping or something. And in fact, a few years ago, I got an email from her. This would have been 15 years later, roughly. She had come across me online somewhere and found my email address. And so she emailed me, and she sent me a picture of her fighter plane. She was an Air Force fighter pilot at this point. Very nice girl. Hope she's still alive. But in any case, so it's a bright line rule, and it's got the fault of a bright line rule, that what you really care about is maturity, and age is a very imperfect proxy for maturity. On the other hand, what would it really mean if what the Constitution said instead was, must be at least as mature as the average 35-year-old? What does that translate into in practice? Given our legal system, if the rule is, in order to run for president, you must be at least as mature as the average 35-year-old, what does that really mean? You've got it. It means you've got to be acceptable to the Supreme Court. Right. Which is probably not a very good rule. But there are lots of other areas. That is, in traffic laws, you have both bright line rules like speed limits, and you have rules about, dangerous driving and, speed appropriate to the circumstances and so forth. Those are standards. And you can see that there are advantages and disadvantages to both. And to some extent, what those depend on, and it's a point which I think has not been looked at enough in the law and econ literature, is the technology of judging. The question of what kinds of questions can courts answer how well. Because it does no good to say, well, the right rule is if X is true, if courts can't tell if X is true. And yet, since courts have very limited knowledge, that's got to be relevant to what the right rules are. Similarly, in applying Coase's approach to the issue of defining property rights, when you own land, what you really own is a bundle of rights with regard to the land, not an unlimited set of rights. If you decide to prevent trespassers via landmines, you will find that you have exceeded the limit of your rights to your land. And the question is, what rights ought to go in the bundle? And you can think of that in terms of, from a Coasean standpoint, of first, which rights belong together. It does no good to have the right to grow grain if you don't have the right to go on the land to grow grain. But second, if it isn't clear which of the owner of this land, which of them should have a certain right. And if you think about things like the right to make noise on this land, maybe this guy hasn't desired. You then want to think about it from a Coasean standpoint, in part in terms of who is more likely to value it more, but also setting it up so if you get it wrong, you can have a transaction that will fix it. So, for example, I am subject every second of every day to trespass on my land by radio waves and television waves, which without my permission are projected across my private property. If we had a legal regime in which that was a violation of the law, in which I could enjoin for trespass any radio station or television station that broadcast where it could be detected on my property, the transaction costs of the radio station buying permission from every single person within range to transmit would be very high. All right, so that would clearly be a very poor way to define that particular property right. All right. The other points that Coase is making, one of his points is that the fact that an outcome is inefficient relative to what a perfectly wise planner could arrange doesn't tell you if you're doing it right or not, because we don't have any perfectly wise planners available. It might be that you're still using the least bad solution. A further point is that defining one thing as the outcome of the market and the other as government intervening is not very clearly defined, because the market is operating under a system of property rights. Those property rights are largely, many of their details are defined by the government's legal system, and therefore we don't really know what it would mean to say decisions in absence of government intervention. Somewhere there's a wonderful paragraph where he's talking about people complain about the nuisances due to the free market, and he's listing all of the ways that the government decisions are responsible for the set of events he's describing as nuisances of the market, but he says they might be the right decisions. You don't know that a priori. So he's arguing not that government is good or bad, but only that it is intricately involved with the outcomes we actually observe. All right. That's, I think, enough from now on Coase. I will probably study Coase some more on Wednesday. Questions on Coase? All right. I hope you all actually read the essay and that it made some sense to you. It's a fairly unusual case, I think, to have an essay that had a sizable effect on an academic field, most of which really is sort of written in ordinary English and can therefore be followed, although I'm sure there are some technical terms that might confuse people. All right, what am I doing in Chapter 5? And what I'm doing is taking a very, very simple, stylized case based on part of what Coase discusses and trying to see how you would decide the right legal rule for it. All right? And trying to simplify it down so that if you had the necessary information, you could actually, in principle, solve it. And the case I'm considering is one where you have railroads running through farming country, where the locomotives throw sparks. The sparks sometimes start fires in the fields. And as I've specified it, there is a single railroad company and 100 farmers. Can you see why those numbers matter? Why it would be a different problem if there were 100 railroads and one farmer, say? What do those numbers affect in terms of what we're going to be doing? Yep. Sorry, transaction costs. Exactly. That if there is something that benefits one person, he can buy it. If there's something that benefits 100 people, it's not so easy for them to buy it, because each one would prefer to be a free rider and have the others pay for it. So that's the kind of thing which is affected by this noise. Furthermore, I am assuming that in my example that there are two ways of preventing a fire. One of them is for the railroad company to spend money on modifying its locomotive so it doesn't throw sparks. That's what I call a spark arrestor, which I think really existed. I'm not considering, Coase's example is considering the question of how many trains you run a day or whether you run trains and such. And obviously, one way of not throwing sparks is not to run a train. That's a different way you could analyze it, but I'm trying to make the problem simple. So I'm assuming they're going to run some unstated number of trains per day through. Those trains, if unmodified, will start a certain number of fires in wheat fields, but at some cost, they can modify them if they don't throw sparks. But there's another way of preventing sparks, and that is not to grow wheat. That, in my at least imaginary world, I don't know if it's a correct statement of the real agriculture or not, wheat burns and clover doesn't. So in my world, the farmers could prevent the sparks by shifting from wheat to clover. At a cost. Why is there a cost? Well, if clover was a more profitable crop, they'd be growing it already and we wouldn't have this whole problem of fires. So I'm assuming that per acre they can make more money off wheat. How much more money? That we don't know. That's going to be one of the variables. All right, so we now have this system where the railroad has to decide whether or not to put on a spark arrester. The farmers have to decide whether to grow wheat or clover. That gets it down to a fairly simple, you know, binary choice for each one. And what are the outcomes? If what you have is wheat and no spark arrester, what's the result? Fires. If you have wheat and a spark arrester, what's the result? If you have clover and no spark arrester, what's the result? If you have clover and a spark arrester, what's the result? Right. So that's basically it. I'm trying to get it down to a sufficiently simple choice system that you can actually work it through. And we then have a question of who has the rights. And we can think about both which party has the right and what kind of a right it is. So that if the farmers have a property right against sparks, that means they can go to the court and get an injunction forbidding the railroad from throwing sparks. And in my world, at least, the railroad would have to respond to that by putting on a spark arrester. Obviously, if I had to answer your story, they could also just stop running railroads. But for the moment, they are going to... If the railroad has a liability right but not a property right, then the railroad can't require a spark arrester, but it can sue and collect damages for any damage done by the fires. Alternatively, the railroad could have a right. If the railroad has a property right, that means it's our locomotive. We don't have to put a spark arrester on if we don't like, you don't want fires in your wheat fields. That's too bad. Sorry about that. Alternatively, and this is somewhat more complicated, well, it's not more complicated, it just seems that's natural. The railroad could have a liability right, which means that the decision on spark arresters is made by the farmers, but they've got to pay for the cost of it. All right. I'm not considering, as you may have noticed, another way in which I'm simplifying is I'm not considering a case where, for example, the railroad can order the farmers to switch to clover. That would you could expand the model to do that, but I'm not getting it complicated. All right, but the situation where the farmers can demand that there be a spark arrester, but then they are liable for the cost of the spark arrester, is a legal rule called incomplete privilege. It's not a very common rule, but there's at least one famous case whose name I've forgotten involving, I think, a cattle feedlot or something of that sort, where basically the equivalent of my pig farm, except that that was as if you had had the pig farm case and the... suburban development got to shut down the pig farm, but then had to pay the cost due to shutting down the pig farm. Well, it wasn't pigs, it was cattle, I think. And it was on a larger scale than most pig farms. Anybody know the name of the case? I've forgotten it. But anyway, but there is a real case, which is the one that books give as the example of the incomplete privilege. So I'm limiting myself to those four possibilities. And then what I'm going to do is to say, look, here are four legal rules you might have. And here are four outcomes that might be the efficient outcome. It might be that the efficient outcome is to do nothing and have fires. It might be the efficient outcome is to stop the fires with a spark arrester. It might be the efficient outcome is to stop the fires by switching to clover. Can't be that the efficient outcome is to have both a spark arrester and clover, but that could happen. No reason why it should happen, but it could happen, so we might as well put it on our graph too, even though we never want to actually get there. All right? So we have four possible rules, four possible outcomes. And for each rule, the question is, how do we get to each outcome? Because if it's easy to get from rule one to outcome three, then if we knew that outcome three was what we wanted, great, rule one is the right legal rule. If it's easy to get from rule one to either outcome three or outcome four, and we're pretty sure that one of those two is the efficient outcome, then again, that would be the right rule. Gets more complicated. We say we're not quite sure. There's some probability this is the efficient outcome, some probability that one is, and we then choose our rule accordingly. All right, but what we're basically doing is looking at starting points, looking at ending points, saying, how hard is it to get from each starting point to each ending point, and then picking a starting point accordingly. I suppose you could imagine, if you imagine a race or some kind of a physical equivalent where you say you could start in one of these four places and we're going to roll dice to decide where we're going to tell you to end up. And you've got to decide, well, there's a marsh here in your way, so and so forth. Anyway, I'm not going to try to do that, but you could, I imagine, set up something along those lines. All right. Now, the reason... So, those are the alternatives we're considering. So let's start with the railroad has the property right. If the railroad has the property right, and sparks plus wheat plus fire is the outcome, no problem. The farmers may not agree with me, but legally speaking, there's no problem. The railroad throws sparks, and the farmers learn to live with fires. All right? Suppose that sparks plus clover is optimal. Do you see what's going to happen? Here's what I mean by optimal. I mean that the cost of... The first one is the cost is the situation where the damage done by the fire is less than the cost of either putting on a spark arrest or a shift to clover. Does that make sense? That's when that's the efficiency optimal. Suppose that the fires do more damage than the cost of shifting to clover, but that the spark arrestor is more expensive than the clover. What's going to happen? Railroad runs trains. Trains throw spark. Now what happens? The farmers look at it and they say, it isn't profitable to grow grain with this many fires. We can make more money growing clover instead, because that won't have the fires. So no negotiation involved. Nobody sues anybody, and you get clover. All right? So those are straightforward. On the other hand, if the best solution is a spark arrestor, how would you have to get the spark arrestor? This is in a world where the railroad has a property right. How would you get the railroad to put on the spark arrestor?
Farmers would have to find it.
Farmers would have to go to the railroad and say, we'll offer you this much, at least as much as the spark arrestor costs, to put on a spark arrestor. And what blocks that is the public good problem. The fact that the 100 farmers are buying something which, if they get it, benefits all of them. So each of them has got an incentive to say, great idea, but I'm sorry, I'm hard up this year, so you people pay for it. And it may not be impossible, that's going to make it more difficult. So that's a case. And we can then graph that. And you've seen the end of the chapter, so you know why I call it a spaghetti diagram. Starting here, direct route to that, direct route to that, route to that that is blocked by a public. So if there were two or three farmers, probably not a problem. If there are 1,000, probably insuperable problem. All right. Everybody clear so far with that stuff? Good. Great. Yes?
You have your book is a dotted line, not a direct line, because of the transaction cost.
Yeah.
So
doesn't matter.
Oh, okay.
This way, right. I was
drawing. Okay.
This one, I'm just using that blocking.
Oh, okay. All
right. I don't even know if the program I drew that with let me do dotted lines, so okay. It probably did. Oh, I may have mentioned this before. If any of you want to draw figures on a Macintosh, I have now discovered that the Apple version of what I think is called NeoOffice, the open source version, the open source equivalent to Microsoft Office, which you can download for free. And unlike Microsoft Office, it's got a drawing module. So it's actually a free program for which you can draw things like this, the much fancier things. Now, I should say it's quite frustrating because I'm trying to figure out how to use it as I draw stuff. But my impression is that once you figure it out, it's pretty powerful, and it doesn't cost anything. All right. So that's the first case, is property rights by farmers. Sorry, property rights by railroad. What about property rights by farmers? Let's think about the same issue. If the farmers have a right to... If each farmer, each individual farmer can say, you are not allowed to start fires on my private property. This is private property, after all. And you keep your sparks in your locomotive. Don't let them drift onto my land. And they'll arrest you, or they'll do something terrible to you if you don't do that. Now what happens? What if the right solution is sparks plus wheat equal fires? How would you get to that solution?
I'm sorry, which one?
The first one,
responsible for EDP players.
The railroad would have to buy the right from
the railroad would have to buy from each farmer the right to throw sparks.
Right.
By their agreeing not to enjoin its running its locomotive without a spark booster. What's the problem going to be with that?
There's a lot of transaction costs involved.
What particular kind of transaction problem you're facing then? It's not the same thing as the public good problem, although it's a sort of a similar problem. Hold on problem, that's right. That this time what's happening is that each railroad, each farmer says to himself, you know, it's going to save the railroad a lot of money if they have to put on this expensive spark arrestor. And if they don't have my permission, they're going to have to put it on. So whatever, you know, let's suppose that the railroad is willing to pay a total of $1 million to have the permission not to put on a spark arrestor. That's $10,000 per farmer. Of course, it's going to try to offer less than that. If 10,000, if the damage done by the buyers is, let's say, only a couple of thousand, maybe it'll offer the farmers 4,000. And so I, being an enterprising fellow, say to myself, well, if everybody else accepts that offer, wonderful. They've still got more than $50,000 left on the table. They should pay all that to me because I can block this transaction all by myself. Everybody or many people see that potential, and there is at least then a sizable risk that the deal will never go through because there are so many people in a blocking position. All right. So, oopsie. So that's the problem getting there. Why don't we start here and want to get to sparks plus clover equal no fire? Well, but I'm assuming that clover is always more expensive. Yeah, clover is always less profitable than wheat. So what negotiations would get to that efficient solution? Exactly the same as before, except that after the railroad has bought the right to throw sparks, now the farmers decide to switch to clover.
Because switching to clover is better than having fires.
Right. So, that's the same. How about no sparks plus wheat and no fires? What transactions are needed for that one if the railroads have the right? Yeah, no transactions are needed. That is, you could argue that the injunction is a transaction. In terms of the system, the framework we're doing, if the farmers have the right to forbid the sparks, if the cost of preventing the sparks is less than the damage the fires do and less than the loss from switching to clover, the farmers have no incentive to accept any offers. They just forbid the railroad from throwing sparks. Get there directly. How about... Well, no, I'm not going to do this one because this is never the efficient outcome. All right? So, farmers have the property right. All right, all clear. So that gives us the second part of the spaghetti diagram, where this should be sitting over both the knees. This block might be moved up a little wider. This block would be over those roots. All right, my mistake. I'll fix it for next time if I remember. I don't think I can change it now, though. All right. How about, let's take our next story. How about liability right by the farmers, meaning the farmers can't forbid sparks, but they can collect damages. All right? So, in order, how do we get the sparks plus wheat fires in a world where they can collect damages?
I'm sorry, we're number two or number three.
We're starting with three.
Okay.
We've done this already, and we're now going on to the next one. If I switch to the next slide, you'll see my answers. So that's why I'm going to start it first and then go to the slide. All right? So, I don't know how legible this is, but liability right by farmers getting to any of the A, B, C, and D. So the farmers can sue for damages. So what's going to happen in order that the railroad keep on throwing sparks?
They have to pay like the litigation.
That's right. All that's going to happen, the only way that could not work is if the court isn't reliable. If the court greatly overestimates the damage, let us say, then you would need some further transaction to keep throwing sparks. But as long as the court can measure the damages, then if that's if that one is the efficient result, what happens is that the the railroad runs its locomotives. They throw sparks. Sparks start fires. Railroad farmers sue. Railroad pays them. Repeat forever. All right? Now, it might be, you might argue that just to save paying too much to the lawyers, after a couple of years of this, you'd have a long-term settlement in which the railroad would agree, instead of looking each year at the number of fires, we'll pay you $X thousand a year, and you'll agree not to sue us. That would be a way of... Yes? Maybe. You could. Yeah. I mean, you get to decide what you consider, so to speak, but whether you want to assume perfectly functioning courts or not is really a question of what your simplifying assumptions are. And you should certainly at least keep in the back of your mind the fact that you don't have perfectly functioning courts, and therefore, I don't remember which way off, yeah, which way I drafted in a minute, but certainly if we assume, as it were, that the rule... One way of looking at it is to assume my property rules are self-enforcing, as it were, not worrying about that, including the liability one, and that it's only the negotiations between the parties. But it is worth noticing that it does depend on the court getting it right and that lawyers charge money, which is one reason you're studying to become lawyers. All right. And what if the efficient rule is sparks plus clover?
That's a little bit tricky.
The railroad is throwing sparks. The sparks are starting fires. The farmers can sue the railroad to collect the damages of the fires. Suppose that shifting to clover costs less than the damage done by the fires. Is it in the interest of the farmers to do it? No, because they're getting reimbursed for the fires. So in order to get to clover, what's the next step that's going to happen? Yep. The railroad goes to the farmer and says, look, at the moment we are paying you $10,000 a year in damages for your fires. We would like to make a deal. You agree to switch to clover, and we'll pay you $3,000 a year, an amount that's enough so you're better off with clover plus what we're paying you than you would have been growing wheat without fires, which is what the liability rule gives you, but still a lower cost to us than the other way. Notice that this one is not blocked by the holdout problem because we don't require all of the farmers to do it. Any farmer that doesn't, we just keep paying damages for the wheat field fires. So each farmer is individually better off accepting our offer. He doesn't have a block. And there's not a public good problem either. So in that sense, this one is, as it were, an easier transaction problem than the two that we were discussing before. You ought to figure out how to tell this machine not to go to sleep. Had a long day. No sparks, wheat, and no fires. The damages we were paying are larger than the cost of the spark arrestor. We put on the spark arrestor, no problem.
That's fine.
And we're not interested in our redundant outcome.
All right. So... All right, so that's what we just said, and I'm just writing it through in print. All right. Finally, next part of our spaghetti diagram,
possibility of court errors on litigation costs, some negotiation costs, but not very much, and no real problem as long as the court doesn't make mistakes. Except a bribe by the railroad, for example, to find that the fires really do no damage at all. So then our last one is, suppose we start with liability right by the railroad. So now any farmer who likes can enjoin, but if he enjoins, he's got to pay for it. All right. So that's sort of an odd one, but I'm putting it in for symmetry. As we'll see later, there are some other rules we could start with, so this is not an exhaustive list of possible rules. But it's a set which should have a certain
symmetry with regard to each other because we've got two alternatives and we're trying to reach them both ways.
All right.
So, in that case, if sparks plus wheat equal fires is the right answer, what's going to happen? You, Mr. Farmer, could stop those fires that you're complaining about very easily. All you got to do is pay for a spark arrestor. If the... What? Sure, it is. The reason we're in the top case is because the spark arrestor is expensive, right? The reason we're in that case is the fires are doing less damage than the cost of the spark arrestor, so no farmer is willing to make that deal, even if there weren't the problem of which farmer pays for it. All right? So, therefore, in that case, we go straight. There, no problem. How about sparks plus clover and no fires? How do we get that? That's right. Even if...
So that would also mean that if the damage of wheat is more than it would to replace the clover.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. That's right. Clover is cheaper than fires and cheaper than spark arrestor. What we're saying. That's right. Uh-huh. And
how do we get from here to no sparks plus wheat equal no fires? This may be a little tricky. What's the problem?
What's going to make it harder than it ought to be to get to that outcome? Each individual farmer, after all, is going to say, well, the cost of the spark arrestor is much more than the damage being done to me by the fires. So it really requires the farmers to all agree we will jointly enjoin, jointly pay the damages. And if they can do that, that will solve the problem. But that's going to run into a public trouble.
Right.
And again, we're not really interested in the last part of that. So, continuing as we were going... Railroad has a liability right, and if a spark arrest is off, it may not happen, but if no spark arrest, it's easy. All right. Can you see, by the way, that one of my simplifying assumptions in a way here is that the court is not very bright? Do you see what the mistake is that the court is making in... Let me take the... Just a minute. Let's go through here. Suppose I consider liability right by farmers. When the railroad throws sparks and the court says, all right, here is the acreage that was burned up in those fires, here's the value of the wheat you lost, that's the amount of damages. Why are they really making a mistake? A very likely mistake, but a mistake. Even a mistake, arguably, in terms of the common law of torts. If you are the victim of a tort, what obligation do you have?
Duty to minimize
the damages, that's right. But the farmers are not minimizing the damages because in some of these cases, it will be cheaper to switch to clover than to have the fires. So a sufficiently clever court might say, sorry, you should have switched to clover. We therefore will only reimburse you for what it would have cost you to switch to clover, not for the damage done to the wheat, and that will then remove one step for getting to clover. All right. So again, I'm just sort of trying to, in a way, I'm trying to show how the world is more complicated. Part of what's interesting about this exercise is that the grossly simplified exercise is still complicated. And I'm pointing out some of the ways in which I'm simplifying it by making sort of clear assumptions about what the court does or doesn't know. Which I think, as we'll see right later in the semester as well, what you assume courts do or don't know is relevant to what you think the right rules are. All right. So let's step back and look at the situation. So if you knew what was optimal, now life would be pretty easy. You just say, is there a straight line unblocked that points to the optimal outcome? Great, the other end of that line is where we want to start. There are two flip a coin. But if this is more likely, you say, well, sometimes spark arresters are the best solution, but other times clover is the best solution. And there are times we have to put up with fires. Now you have a much more complicated situation, and now you're going to have to engage in some sort of a, this is my estimate of the probabilities of those. well, this one is usually right, but occasionally wrong, and so forth and so on. It's going to be how you're going to have to do it. And now we get the full-scale spaghetti diagram. Actually, wait a minute. I think I'm doing this wrong. I think if I actually tell it that it's a slideshow, why is it doing it that way? I don't know. Huh. I'm supposed to be able to view this thing in a way that uses the whole screen, which would look nicer. That's a slideshow. No, but I want to show the next one, too. Why is it telling me the next one? Ah, forget about it. For some reason, it wants, in this version, it wants to do two things. Maybe because I have a widescreen or something. So anyway, but the spaghetti diagram is really the bottom line of this, and I'm only using the computer because I didn't really want to try to draw all that stuff on the screen. And this time I do have to see the final version, making copies of the book. So if you knew that you were going to end up here, you would say, well, one of these was the place to stop it. You were end up here, you would say, well, this or this is the place to start and so forth. And if you said, well, it might be this or it might be this, well, then we want to start here. If we say it might be this or it might be this, we want to start here. And so what you can see the logic of it. And let me see what I was going to. And in order to really do it right in a complicated world, you would have to have a good enough theory of transaction costs so you can not only say there's a problem, but how bad a problem is it? How costly will it be to get that? Or in what range of cases will we not get that? And notice that for all of these transaction cost problems, there is really a double cost. That if you're in a situation where the path from where you start to where you end up is blocked by something, there are two different costs you might get. One of them is the cost of overcoming the problem. All right, we've got to spend a lot of time arguing with my fellow farmers before we solve the public good problem and pay for the spark rent. The other is the cost of not solving the problem. That because of that block, we aren't able to solve the public good problem, we don't get the spark arrestor, and we get fires even though it would have been cheaper to put on a spark arrestor. So you would have to, in principle, do this right. Just for this toy example, you would need probabilities of all four of those being the right outcome. For each of them, how much the right outcome it was. How likely is it that spark residues are $1 million more expensive than fires, 999,000, and so forth. You have to imagine a full distribution for the mathematical line. And you would have to have a good enough theory of transaction costs so that you could say when, under which of these circumstances will you succeed in overcoming the cost, and how much will it cost you to do it, under which ones won't you? You could then, in principle, say, with all that information, for each starting point, on average, averaged over everything that will ever happen, what is the summed cost of solving transaction cost problems and of not solving transaction cost problems and thus getting inefficiencies? Pick the one for which is lowest. We've solved the problem. We've just written a legal code. Just written one line of a legal code or a little tiny bit of a legal code. All right? So that's the basic logic of what... Ah, yes, I just thought this was amusing in Coase. All right, well, although with reluctance, confine my discussion to rabbits. But if you go back, you can find where that is. Let me run through some further things along these lines. Let's consider a fifth rule. And the fifth rule is a Pigouvian tax rather than a liability. So suppose what we do is to say that when the railroad throws sparks, it has to pay a fine for the damage done by the fires, but the fine goes to the state, not to the farmers. All right? At first glance, you might say, well, that looks pretty good. It looks pretty good. Because on that one, the farmers aren't compensated. So if clover is the best solution, the farmers have an incentive to switch to clover. Once the farmers will switch to... Well, that's interesting. Once the farmers will switch to clover, of course, the railroad stops having to pay any fines because there are no fires anymore. But it knows that if it did... But that then shows you what the problem is. Because let's suppose the spark arrestor is the cheapest solution. And the railroad says it'll cost us $100,000 to put on a spark arrestor. It'll cost per year. It'll cost us $80,000 a year to pay damages for the fires. So therefore, what should we do? And the railroad does not put on the spark arrestor. And the vice president comes to the president and says, what are you doing? Why are you wasting our stockholders' money? The president says, be patient. And what's going to happen pretty soon?
Farmers switch to clover.
They're not getting compensated. Once they switch to clover, the fires disappear. Once the fires disappear, we stop paying any damages. Now, a sufficiently wise court would say you still owe damages equal to the losses due to switching to clover. But just as in the previous case, I'm assuming the courts can measure burn fields. They can't go through the accounts of farmers and decide what their costs were and different alternatives. So therefore, here again, in the same situation. And a further problem is the one we discussed before when I said that Coast plus Pigou was too much of a good thing. Suppose we have a case where sparks are optimal. Where clover is very expensive, so we're not going to consider that, but where the spark arrestor costs $100,000 and the damage done is $80,000. And the problem is that you would think that what would happen would be that the railroad would keep throwing sparks, but what's going to happen when they keep throwing sparks? Who are they going to hear from? They're hearing from the regulator, which they're saying, we're paying you $80,000 a year, just like you said, Mr. Pigou, those are our orders. Now who's going to show up at the railroad's door? The farmers. And if the farmers can solve their public good problem, at least somewhat solve it, they go to the railroad and say, we'll offer you $30,000 a year to stop throwing sparks. And when it stops throwing sparks, it saves $80,000 a year that it was giving to the government. It gets $30,000, that's $110,000, that more than pays for the spark arrestor. And you get an inefficiently low number of fires. All right? So that's a farther problem. Now, this is a case where the public good problem helps us, because the public good problem means that it probably won't happen, but in principle it could happen. All right? Now, I had another question for you. Let's see what else I have. And the other question is related to what I was doing today. It has to do with PowerPoints. Last time I taught this course here 2 years ago, I used PowerPoints. I have rather mixed views of PowerPoints. That on the one hand, it sort of makes it easier to see the structure of what's going on. On the other hand, I worry that you get less interaction and less conversation because, there is this fixed structure up there that you're getting rather than, what do you want to talk about? What are your questions? So what I would appreciate would be if any of you who have strong views, either pro or anti-PowerPoint, send me an email. If you either think that the course would be noticeably better if I switched back to using PowerPoints, which is really easy to do because I got them from 2 years ago, all I have to do is to go and edit a little bit, tell me so. If you think it would be worse if I used PowerPoints, tell me so. I don't think we need to. Yep.
The process is the PowerPoint you had after the class.
The PowerPoints are all there.
Other than.
The PowerPoints in 2 years are up on the webpage. So look at them, in fact, and you'll get some idea with it. What I just showed you was the PowerPoints from 2 years ago, minus most of them. I just took out that one chunk because I wanted to be able to draw my diagrams. And if I had thought about it a little more, I would have figured out how to get this thing to actually make them full-size slides, and it would have been easier to read. But anyway, so if you could think about that question and let me know, that would be useful. Let's see. I think the next thing we're doing, if I remember correctly, is insurance. Is that right? Uncertainty? I have to look at the syllabus. Or are we doing that? I don't even remember. What's the chapter after this chapter? Chapter 6.
It's economics and risk.
Yeah, it's risk. So it's insurance, risk, that sort of stuff. So let me spend a few minutes again talking about that to sketch through. What?
Oh, so that's next Monday, correct?
Yeah, right. That's right. Yeah, no, we're going to be talking about more of this stuff.
Okay.
I've got it. Now you're perfectly right. Yeah, we've got more of this stuff Wednesday. But I only printed out my notes through what I was planning to cover today, so I don't have the notes for what I'm covering next time, which is a
more extensive analysis of the same set of questions, basically. So, which is what I ought to talk about. So I don't remember what's there. I thought I would say a little bit about insurance and use up at least 5 minutes or something. This time my voice seems to be surviving the class, so I'm getting better. So if you think about risk, part of the reason it's in the book is that a lot of legal rules and a lot of contracts are about allocation of risk. That there are many cases in which there is no way of acting, in which there isn't some chance of something going wrong, and one of the things the law decides is when something goes wrong, who pays for it. So it sort of the primitive response is whoever's fault it was, and the more you think about it, the less clear it becomes what that means. So that if you go back to Kosa's point, is it the fault of the airlines or is it the fault of the guy who built the house under the flight path? Is it my fault for driving at night or your fault for wearing dark clothes and walking at night and crossing the street where I couldn't see you very easily at Malta, etc.? Or to take a real example, a good many years ago, one of my colleagues who will remain nameless came to dinner with his wife, and they parked their car in our driveway. And I, at some point in the evening, for some reason, was pulling my car out of the driveway and wasn't used to there being another car parked in the driveway, and the result was to a mild dander scrape on the sides of their car. And I, being a proper, generous, honest host, promptly offered to pay the cost of fixing it. The only problem was that my colleague's car was a Mercedes, with the result that that cost was a good deal more than it would have been if it was a Ford. Well, whose fault was it? It was my fault that I carelessly scraped his car, and it was his, quote, fault, unquote, that he chose to have a car that was expensive to repair instead of a car that was cheap. All right, so that would be one very simple example of the problem. So it isn't really enough to say whatever fault it was or whoever caused it. We'll spend some time later in the semester on causation, which turns out to be, in fact, I'll let you think about that now. Here's my favorite, one of my couple of favorite causation paradoxes. I got two favorite causation paradoxes. Tell me now, because they're both entertaining. One of them is a friend comes walking down the street. You stop him to chat for a moment. He then goes on, and half a block later, a safe falls out of a third-story window and crushes him flat. Did you kill him? All right. If you hadn't stopped him, he would have been 20 feet farther away, and the safe would have missed him. There's some sense in which you killed him, which you caused his death. Right? Simplest concept of causation is but-for causation. Well, but-for you're stopping him, he would be alive today. My second case, which sort of goes the other way, is three men go deer hunting, and two of them are rather careless hunters, with the result that they simultaneously shoot the third, one through the heart and one through the head. All right? Who caused his death? And when the legal process supposes is tortious loss of life, not murder. It was not deliberate. And so when the widow sues for damages, and the first man says, well, I am perfectly willing to pay the damages I caused, those being the extra cost at the mortuary of covering up the hole in his heart so that his corpse would look good. But he would have been just as dead if I never fired, because one bullet through the head is enough to kill him. And the other guy says, well, I am equally willing to pay the costs I imposed, which are the part of the mortuary bill for making his head look nice, which is harder than since heads get really messed up by bullets. But, of course, he would have been just as dead if I hadn't fired, because one bullet through the heart is enough to kill him. Who killed him? All right. Those are causation puzzles, which are worth thinking about if you think causation is simple. All right. So given that, you will then note that one of the things tort law is doing is deciding who bears risks. You will also note that one of the things that contract drafting is doing, that when you are drafting a contract, one of the central issues is if something goes wrong, if the cost of one of the inputs goes up, if the demand for our goods disappears, if the new computer chips that you were working on now turn out not to work. It turns out that getting down to whatever it was, 80 nanometer or something, is harder than you thought it was going to be. Who pays for it? All right. That was a real case. Not a legal case, but I gather that part of what resulted in Apple switching from Motorola to Intel was that there was a point at which both of them were making the shift to the next size smaller for their CPUs, and Motorola was not able to do it as quickly as Motorola thought they would do it, with the result that Apple essentially promised their people new computers and then didn't happen because they didn't have enough reliable production of CPUs for it. Apple switched their supplier. But in any case, all of those are really cases of allocation of risk. And so, since the insurance industry is in the business of allocating risk, one useful way to think about questions of risk allocation is to think about it in terms of the context of growing insurance. And insurance ends up really, as you'll see when we get to that chapter, we end up really with four different issues. First is, why do you buy insurance? And the answer to that is risk aversion. And risk aversion, I think I went through with you at some point earlier, is a misleading term, because what it really is aversion to risk in money. And what that really is not aversion to risk. It's recognition of the fact that, as a general rule, the more money you have, the less each additional dollar is worth to you, what we call declining marginal utility income. And given that, you are willing to give up dollars in states of the world where you've got lots of them in order to get dollars in states of the world where you have few of them. All right. It's not really risk aversion, because the same guy who insures his house might also go out skydiving for fun. Some people like risk in that sense. So that's the first point. The second point is, what's the problem with insurance? And the first problem with insurance is what we call moral hazard. And that's the fact that the more the cost of some risk is borne by somebody else, the less your incentive to prevent it. So that if you have $10 million factory and it's not insured, you are willing to take any precaution where the cost of the precaution is less than the savings and expected loss from the factory breaking down. So if you've got a $1,000 precaution, which will reduce by one part in 1,000 the chance of a $10 million loss, that precaution is worth $10,000, cost you $1,000, you should obviously take it. On the other hand, if you've got that whole $10 million is covered by the insurance company, why throw $1,000 away? If the factory burns down, that's the insurance company's loss, not yours. So if you think about it, the higher the fraction of the factory is insured, the larger the range of precautions that you should take and look to. All right? Because you're getting only some of the benefit. So that's moral hazard. Second problem is what's called adverse selection. And that's the problem that occurs when one of the two parties has more information about the risk than the other. So you're in the life insurance business, and somebody comes running into your office and says, I want $10 million in life insurance right now. What is your conclusion? He's just discovered that the woman he's having an affair with is the wife of the local mafia don, or the equivalent. Right. The problem is that the same argument applies to everybody who comes into your office, just less extremely. The reason they buy, on average, the reason people buy life insurance is because they think they're only poor risks. Doesn't mean that everybody is, but the worse a risk, you know more about the chance of your collecting on life insurance than the insurance company does usually, because you know what kind of life you live. And the worse a risk you are, the better a deal insurance is for you. And therefore, the distribution of people who buy life insurance is biased towards the bad risks. That means that the people who sell life insurance, insofar as they don't know what the chances are, have got to think of you as a worse-than-average risk when you buy, because on average, that's who the people who buy their product are. But that means if you're really an average risk or a better-than-average risk, insurance is a really bad deal for you. And the result is that there will be people who would pay more than the actuarial cost of their insurance who don't get insurance. Because by buying it, they signal they're at bad risk. That's what's called adverse selection. I think I'll leave you with those. Stop a minute earlier. So, see you all Wednesday. By which time I will have figured out what I'm supposed to be talking about Wednesday.